Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So it's a significant day on our calendar. It's the end of Asa. We had the Pavarna this morning where we made an invitation for reflection and nourishment. And as I was saying to the Sangha this morning, we've had a chance to create a lot of wholesome kamma. We've lived together according to Dhamma Vinaya. Sometimes it seems a very, very obvious thing, but not many people actually are living in that way. We studied the Vinaya, we studied our own minds, we've worked hard to provide food and take people to doctors and go shopping and balance accounts and organize work, and we've created friendships. I don't think we've created much enmity. We've had disagreements, but we've always worked to go beyond the kind of static nature of disagreements. We've cared for sick bhikkhus. We've rejoiced at happy bhikkhus. And you can think of the own. You know, in your own way, you can think of all the wholesome things that have taken place during this time. And to always kind of remember the larger context of our life here, because the more narrow context sometimes is just the particular inner problems you might be facing, annoyances or painful bodily predicaments or doubts about your own capacities and abilities, self-doubts, or whatever it might be. And those can sometimes be very kind of dominant themes because they're sort of foremost in your consciousness. But actually, to always look at that larger thing, the way we're living, that we're keeping precepts, that we're living by the Vinaya precepts of the Buddha, is very refined, that we're living according to the hierarchy that we're asked to live in. We're giving up our personal preferences and being responsible for whatever we're asked to do. So this is quite wonderful. It's quite a good thing to reflect on. This part of our life during the Vassa is, although in Thailand it's a retreat time, for us it's a very fraternal time, a very communal time. There's much to do. Summer is a time a lot can get done. Venerable Kimiko has a really good vision of all the things that need to be accomplished, and we're all tremendously grateful for that. The books, the balance books. So we're tremendously grateful to Lama Siri for keeping on to that one. And of course, Anagarbhas feed us and drive, and Nirasa does that, and Venerable Ajahn Pavro keeps me happy in the workshop. Chakaro can fix anything, and Sirimedo is a great carpenter. And so we can feel it's good to realize the good qualities of each other without making it a kind of Oscar ceremony. And the Vasa, who was the best bhikkhu, or who made the best lap joint, or something like that. It's not about ego, it's about appreciation. And we have the capacity to appreciate each other's goodness. We have that capacity to appreciate, also to be irritated at each other's character, personality. So both are there. Our critical faculty can certainly find fault, and there's nothing wrong with that. We can admonish each other when necessary, but also that we can appreciate how hard this monastic life really is. It's not easy. It can look easy from the outside, because it looks kind of easy, doesn't it? We get room and board, and the rustle drives us here, there, and everywhere. Piece of cake. But of course, the challenge of this life is that it stops the capacity to distract. It stops the capacity to make choices based upon a lot of your own preferences. So within the gift that we're given of the four requisites, within that gift, our giving to, getting back to it, is the sense of giving up to it, the sense of, okay, this is the situation, these are the parameters, these are the people I live with, this is the weather, this is the environment, this is the kuti I have, and this is where I sit in the hierarchy, and these are my responsibilities, and I'll give up to that. That's my vehicle, that's what I'm going to travel in, and observe the nature of liking and disliking, the nature of success and failure, the nature of suffering and the end of suffering. So the freedom we're given by being given the four requisites by the lay people, it's not the freedom of choice, although we have some choice, obviously, not the freedom of kind of consumer choice, but we're given the freedom to observe within those quite tight boundaries that we are asked to live in. And that's a particular kind of freedom. Freedom to choose isn't usually a freedom, it's just a seeming kind of freedom that is just driven by greed, hate, illusion. Sometimes it's not, oftentimes it is. So this freedom to observe the way things are, the way I relate to someone, or like someone, don't like someone, and there's nothing wrong with that. And it's the beauty of this life, is that we're not asked to like each other, we're just asked to be respectful to each other. We're not asked to be a fan of anyone. We're just asked to be kind and compassionate and exercise goodwill towards each other. And goodwill is not liking. It's not disliking either. It's just it's an aspect of the heart which is bigger than liking or disliking. And that's very important to get that clear, isn't it? So I can certainly at times feel irritated by someone, or frightened of someone, or jealous of someone, or whatever it might be. But I can always wish them goodwill. And that's a skill that we're constantly developing in Sangha, aren't we? We come together in a ritual. We chant together. We chanted the Bhavarana this morning. It was lovely. And those rituals are it's quite easy to be harmonious in a ritual, unless all the voices are really messed up. But we have good voices now. Amara Siri is a good chanter, and Siri Maidon. So our voice carries us, and we harmonize, and we have this kind of ritual theater that we do called Theravada Buddhism. Puja and chanting, this is quite lovely, it brings us together. But it's not fraternal. Because we can leave the space of this kind of religious dance we do, the dance of ritual, and not be connected to each other, not want to be connected with each other, feel alienated from each other. So it's not... It's a part of our tradition. Ritual is a beautiful part, but there are many, many more elements. So we've had this chance during Svasa to do our heart meetings, and that's the attempt to develop a more fraternal feeling to each other, trying to minimize the hierarchy. It's a very strong hierarchy, and as Westerners, we're not quite used to that, maybe. maybe the Ramasu is more used to it from his culture, but our culture can seem very foreign, these strong hierarchies, but they exist and work. So that heart meeting that we've been having, it's an attempt to create more sense of fraternal camaraderie. It's not really possible 100%. I'm much older than most of you, closer to Venerable Pavo, Venerable Kimiko, and more Pansa, so I'm very senior and all that. So there'll always be a sense of deference, which is okay. And that's a part of our life, is how do we do authority and fraternity? How do we do authority well? Because there is that in the Sangha, and there's that in life. How do we do leadership well, and how do we do fellowship well? Authority changes in Sangha life according to circumstance, according to responsibility, according to seniority, according to capacity. It's not a fixed thing. It's kind of malleable and flexible, but it has its place. Because if we didn't have someone, you know, sitting here talking or taking the meal first or whatever, we'd have to have a democratic vote every morning or something. So we have both fraternity, but we have authority too. And we have seniority. And these are the elements of our monastic life, which we are trying to understand how, as Westerners, how can we do this? We get insights from someone like Venerable Siri, who has it more in his culture. But perhaps he gets things from us, how we do things. I don't know. As Westerners, we have a very egalitarian culture. Everyone's kind of equal, which has its place. And in Thailand, much more hierarchical, very strong hierarchies. And so I think we're trying to find some kind of middle way for us in the West. And so it's an experiment. This whole Western Buddhism thing is a kind of experiment, how are we going to do this? And that openness of conferring with each other and indicating where things just don't seem right, we converse about through the Vinaya. And this morning, was it yesterday? During yesterday at the heart meeting, we had a really good talking about Upatak and how that's seen in Thailand and how some of us receive that. And these are very healthy discussions, because that means we're not just sectarian, we're not just mimicking Thailand and trying to do things a Thai way. We're kind of trying to be authentic and see, well, what is, as Westerners, how can we live this bhikkhu life? Because although we have the Vinaya and we have models from Thailand, we also have models from Abhayagiri and Amaravati and so on, and then we have our own needs here, and this is very, you can't really hold a position with all this. If you do, you're not going to create any kind of harmony. You're just going to create fear, I suppose. But if it's held in a way of, well, what works, what are the Vinaya recommendations, what are the great standards, And who are we as Westerners, and what works and what doesn't work? And that kind of dialogue, that kind of consideration, keeps us from becoming too parochial, too narrow. Because personally, I didn't ordain to be a Buddhist. You know, I love the sasana, but I didn't ordain to somehow be exclusively one mode. And so, to see that there are other forms of monasticism, other forms of religiosity, other forms of spiritual endeavor. And this is our particular way, so it's neither right nor wrong. And that kind of sectarianism that arises in culture is that's Sīlabbaṭa Paramāsa, the kind of conceit that our way is the only way. And it's a very fearful state of mind. But to kind of be totally... what is it to be kind of so unstructured and unformed, that it becomes a kind of anarchy. That's not our way either. We do have form, we do have structure. And to do that well means to do authority well, to do fraternity well, to do ritual well. These are different ways that we try to live together and do this work of liberation. Of course, included in our lifestyle is solitude, and during the Vasa, during the summer, solitude is not a big piece of our life. It is. We do have spaces, but we've had bhikkhus living in the Bhikkhu Viharas, so it's not very private for them. Solitude there. So the solitary part of our life is coming up. It'll be the winter retreat. And solitude brings forth different challenges to fraternity. And so during this period of the Vasa, we really emphasized how do we live together? How do we communicate together? How do we hold views and opinions which fracture us? And how do we let go of narrow perceptions? How do we communicate discord? How do we make that conscious that we disagree and yet not let it go to some kind of horrible position taking and animosity and so on? So we stress this kind of coming together and trying to do it well for the sake of ourselves, for the sake of the monastery, for the sake of our community that comes here. And I think we've done that very well myself. I think we've done it very well. Again, that's not, that's just what I feel. But then solitude is also terribly important in our life, and the winter retreat is that we're now going to, and I'm speaking of this because I'll be soon gone and I won't be able to be with you to introduce the retreat. But Sir Venerable Klimakul will be introducing the retreat, and so I'm very grateful to him for allowing me to go to Asia and make those connections. But do be very diligent in your times of solitude, because they're rare and precious, and they bring forth different challenges, as I say. On one hand, we had one monk here who was very diligent into making lists of what he's going to achieve during the winter retreat. And it was down. He showed me his schedule. He had it down to every 10 minutes what he was going to do. I thought he was crazy. there was absolutely no sense of ease in this high octane becoming, doing, achieving, structuring. And I laughed. And he, I think he saw. But that's one extreme of just having a mind and thinking, this retreat, I'm going to get this done, I'm going to get that done, I'm going to achieve the jhanas, and I'll get at least anagami, and then I'll do this, and I'll do that, or I'll memorize this, and I'll get that. So because I have a kind of achieving mind, very much bhava tanha, becoming, that's one extreme. The other extreme as well, I'll just chill out, just look at the snow, and have a cup of coffee every now and then. I'll just chill out and relax. That's all right if you have strong samadhi, if you have a strong foundation, but it can be a roadway to despair and depression, actually, because if you get too passive on a winter retreat, if you get too chill, if you get too passive, and it'll be right, you don't put any structure into it, you'll find your mind will spin into habit. And when the mind starts to spin into habit, where does it goes to sexual fantasy, it goes to depression, it goes to, there are major things, but it certainly doesn't go to samadhi. And so you can fritter away a whole month of the winter retreat by just not having focus. You can go crazy with focus and be so determined you burn yourself out and be a total nuisance to everyone else. You can have no focus and just, you know, spend your time walking around, cleaning your kuti, sitting down, just sort of fritting your life away with no focus, no samadhi. Middle way depends on the character, But middle way is that you do develop samadhi. You do take time to develop a form of meditation, that you do take time to develop ways of samadhi, such as learning chanting. So I'm suggesting to say to William, why don't you learn the Patimokkha? Then I downgraded it to the Dhammacakka Sutta. I frightened him with the Patimokkha. But who knows, maybe he'll do it. But what happens when you do that, when you take on, like you have this 3-month span, and you put no structure into it, it's very easy just to kind of drift, just to drift, and sleep a bit too much, hang out a bit too much, and just kind of go for walks, and there's no sharpness, no ujjupiti pranavana. So, but picking something up, which requires some fortitude, some adhitana, some determination, some sustained effort is very important, and that you have to design yourself. Because the idea of our winter retreats is that you don't have structure, there's no one helping you, and there's no one there to carry you, and the rest of the year the form carries you. So we try to see ourselves in both of these situations, social situations. So solitude, for those who enjoy solitude and who are anxious in the company of human beings, it's great, they love it. But so they have to learn in our more fraternal situations. And those who are very gregarious and active and like to be with people, and if they find being alone difficult, well, they also learn, don't they? So our life is that, in a 12-year cycle, we're trying to see, how am I in this situation, in that situation? And learning for both. So again, I have seen people go, like let's say I want to do a retreat, okay, go do a retreat, Chithurst Forest, do a retreat. And the guy Sangati Sesa after a month, because he got depressed and the only avenue he had was Sangati Sesa. And that was not understanding that actually he didn't have the strength to be alone. So it takes a lot of strength, isn't it, to be alone and do that well. So, what are the ways you might structure the winter retreat? Well, again, if your sense of clarity is strong and you can sustain the awakened mind, then it doesn't really matter so much. But usually that's not the case, so what can you do? You can take on develop the habit of sustained formal practice and using the four classic postures, sitting, standing, walking, lying down. There's something about practicing with a formal posture that is very conducive to both seeing where your head's at and also developing strong awareness through time, through sustained time. Because the form of posture is one where you have to hold it. So whether you're doing walking meditation back and forth, you have to hold that posture, which is 20 paces, which has a beginning and an end, and is always defining your practice for you. So as opposed to going for a long walk, long walks are great, and I certainly suggest it during the winter to keep fit and to keep the oxygen levels high or whatever. But going for a long walk hasn't got the focus of formal practice. And so in Theravada Buddhism, we stress that a lot. These times of formal practice are very important in our life. So I realize the winter vortex can be a bit challenging, but don't worry about it. Do it. Go for it. So sometimes we'll do walking practice indoors. That's fine, but do it for an hour. Don't just do it for 5 minutes and say, well, that's it. I've done my formal practice. No, it's something about like doing a whole hour back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, and then sitting for a whole hour, and then walking back and forth, and then sitting, and then walking and sitting. And that's a pattern that's very important in our forest tradition, that pattern. And the winter retreat is very much our opportunity, because the lay people take care of us and fulfill offer us the four requisites, and they're very kind to do that. we have this special time. So be right from the get-go, from whenever Kimiko decides to start that winter retreat, right from the get-go, make your mind strong. Okay, I'm gonna do this. Now that's not a sense of becoming. So you don't do form practice so you can become whatever, because it's not about becoming, it's about awakening. That's the heart of our life. It's the awakened mind. And you know, if you're doing walking practice and your mind drifts off at the end of the walking path, you notice because you're stopped. Oh yeah, here I am, you awaken. And then you start walking the other way, and halfway through you're daydreaming, and then bang, you hit the other end. You awaken. You just keep doing this. You keep encouraging the awakened mind, because that's what will free you. And then you don't want to do it. You don't want to do it anymore, then do it. It's cold, that's fine, do it. You know, kind of challenge yourself in some kind of way where it is a bit difficult. Because if you push yourself just a bit, not in a way where you hurt yourself, you feel good. You've taken something, gone beyond your usual boundaries of you know, kind of marginal laziness we can all get into. You've gone a bit further, you've sat a bit more, you've walked a bit more, you've done a bit more anapanasati, you've picked up a theme of metta bhavana, and you've really worked with it. That's very rewarding. It gives you a good sense of purpose, and you feel like you're really earning your alms food. Whereas if you don't put that kind of effort forth, you feel like you're cheating. You do, don't you? You know, well, these people are working hard and feeding me, and I'm just sort of slacking off. And then you feel guilty, and then that guilty leads to kind of depression, and then that can lead to lustful things and so on. The mind then doesn't like the depression, it starts to create lustful thoughts because that's exciting and interesting, and your whole retreat is down the tube. So, you don't want to go there. And that happens. That's what happens. People don't put effort forth, or don't know how to put effort forth. They just don't know how to do it, or they have all the depression come up, and they get caught in it, and then they go to some excitement. And then they're just lost in the objective experience. That's not the awakened mind. So do consider, like, consider your own character, and this pattern of formal practice for many hours at a time is something that Ajahn Chah encouraged. It's something that I've always did a lot in my early years. And a good run of 5-6 hours should be quite easy for you, no problem. After lunch, what else you got to do? And obviously, like Sri Medu has his illness, and Arasir have their illnesses, so these are not done. I don't want people to push themselves and then we have to hospitalize them. That's not the point of it, is it? So if you have sickness, and you have a whole practice there in itself, it's much, much different, and heads off to you. But if you have strength and you have vitality, use that well, because who knows? Who knows? The tick may bite you. I hope not. There's any hope not. And so adhittana, or determination, is a skill that we are encouraged to develop, and that it's not like setting your mind on a certain theme that you want to look at in your own mind, maybe, or setting your mind on a particular posture you want to develop. Or there's many ways you can do that. Just the discipline of yoga or qigong, or it might be like learning the Dhammacakka Sutta. There's so many ways we can do that in this life. But it's different, you know, like taking a chunk of work and say, yeah, I'm going to really do this for a period of time. It's different than just kind of dibbling and dabbing and you know, a little bit of this and a little bit of that. So try to see if you can find that balance between being just sort of passive, waiting for the clock to go by, and being overly aggressive. And willful, and the bhavatanna is very, very strong, and finding a middle way. And what middle way should be is that the awakened mind is sustained for long periods of time in whatever posture. So what is the awakened mind? It's the knowing of the way things are. And so sati sampajanya, mindfulness and quick comprehension, using the three characteristics, this is the way that we are encouraged from our teachings to come to the awakened mind. So you're feeling upset about something, you're feeling cold, it's like this. And it's changing. What's a changing nature? You're constantly awakening the mind. And the awakened mind is not a thought. It's not an opinion. It's not a mood. It knows. It's the knowing. And it's very important to realize that's the real central core of whatever we do, whether we're doing samatha practice or we're just chopping vegetables. That's the real core of our work. Some people really like to do lots of samatha work, some find it too constrained in some way, but you do need to find out how to abandon the hindrances. That's a very necessary part of developing the mind. So be very careful of dullness and sloth and torpor. If you find that you are trying to meditate and you're in a hot room, open the windows. Put snow on your face. Don't get too passive with the sitting. Sometimes monks can get really good at falling asleep in cross-legged posture. And kind of feels all right. So if you see, like, look at your body, get body awareness. See how strong is your body. Can it sit? And if you're falling asleep, don't sit. Walk for 2 hours. Walk for 3 hours. Really put a lot of effort in. And then see where that takes you. See what that does when you really put forth that kind of effort. It's beautiful. You know, if you've ever done sport and you have a good coach, and the coach really works you, and really makes you do wind sprints and dribble with your left hand rather than your right hand, and you kind of feel awkward and you don't like it, but at the end of it you think, well, thank you. Yeah, that made me stronger. Made me a better athlete. So in a winter retreat, you really have to be your own coach, because we're all doing our own work, and you know, none of us wants to go walking around checking you out. But if you make strong determinations to awaken, what would help you to awaken? That's what determination has to be based on. What kind of things could I do, considering my own character, my own moods, the way I operate? What kind of things would be helpful to sustain the awakened mind? And what kind of things do I have to be careful of that would tend to drag me down into the old habits of complaining or self-doubt or lust or whatever it might be? How do those kinds of habitual enslavements, how do they manifest, and what might I do to awaken to them and not let them dominate consciousness? So for each of us, it's very individual, isn't it? We've got our own karma, our own situations, and things we're going to want to learn from. So the vasa has ended. Endings are usually... Well, endings are this way. Endings condition beginnings. End of vasa is usually quite understated. But what you want to find, of course, is that which is does not end, it does not begin. Emotions arise and cease. The day ends, the day begins. Winter comes, winter goes. The vasa ends. Katina comes, it goes. So there's this movement, there's this constant movement, this sort of like a wave going into the shore and then bouncing back, waves coming in and bouncing back off the shore. And then there's that which is unmoving, that which is not conditioned. What's that about? And that's the awakened mind, isn't it? That's our real home. And our aspiration is just to remember that. And that's not a becoming. Remembering the way things are is not a becoming. It's a recollection. Sati sampajanya, it's like this. So even if you feel... like during the winter retreat, even if you really blow it and you sleep 13 hours and then you go back and sleep for 16 hours and then you overeat and then whatever you do, you can always say, wow, that wasn't a good idea. you can say, I think I won't sleep so much, or I think I'll put more effort in. Or you can hate yourself. You can hate yourself, that's not going to help. You can rationalize. You can say, I'm a delicate thing. I really need to do this, that, and others. You can rationalize, but the awakened mind knows. It just knows. So what kind of things you do, how strong does it make the awakened mind? The kind of moods you follow, how much does it strengthen the sense of ego and self? The kind of narratives your mind goes into, how much does it create self and other? The kinds of samatha practices you do, how much does it create the awakened mind, which is not self and other? These are the questions you're constantly using to monitor your own practice. Not as a judgment, but rather as an awakening to. So what narratives in your own mind create me and you, self and other, time? What kind of thoughts take you there? And what do you need to do to awaken to that? Not go there. Put it down, let go. Not pick it up. Not get reborn into those patterns. Only you can know. Only you can know. And some patterns are insidious. They're just so powerful. They keep grabbing attention, keep taking center stage, and keep overwhelming you. And that's where the perseverance is so important. The determination, no matter what, no matter how difficult it is, I'm going to awaken to this now. And the mind grabs you and throws you for a loop and pins you down on a full Nelson. And then you notice it and you're up again. And again and again and again. It can seem like a real battle, but if you realize that the awakened mind can know all things, and that's the secret. The secret isn't to be a nice person, it's helpful. Or the secret isn't to be healthy, it's helpful. The secret isn't to be perfect in some kind of worldly way. The secret is the awakened mind, which knows perfection and imperfection, like and dislike. So even if you're just feeling averse to everyone for the whole 3 months, somehow you just get slugged by waves and waves of aversion, well, that's what you have to work with. Aversion is this way. Or lust, or self-doubt. So the mood itself is not important, but it's the papancha, the creation of self around the mood that needs to be awakened to. So countering a mood with another, a self mood with another mood, I'm no good, I'm a terrible person, I must do this and I must do that, is not the awakened mind, it's the deluded mind. But awakening is like this, it's silent, it has no structure, it has no narrative, it has no kind of these definitions. All thoughts, you know, really creates itself and other, all the structures that we have, but our Sutta de Bahia, in the scene, there should be just the scene, that pure awakened mind just knows before all the definitions and thought. We need thought, we need to plan, we need to organize, we need to have ways of doing things, but in a winter retreat, what you really get a chance is to take that perspective of anatta. You can take the perspective now of flow of consciousness rather than individual responsibility and self-definition around responsibility, that's necessary, but especially during the winter retreat when there is really so little to be done, you can really, really hone in on anatta and see this is just a flow, it arises and ceases, arises and ceases. And take that perspective, you know, if you're working with Fusion 360 or something, or SketchUp, you have perspective, and you can look at, if you look at an object, you can look at the top, you can look at the bottom, and you look from the side, one side, right side, that's perspective, isn't it? And the perspective of liberation is that this experience is in awareness, that the body is in awareness, that these things arise and cease in awareness. And that perspective, what that perspective does, it takes you to that place which is very hard to get to, this, that this body is a natural body and you are not embodied in that. That's not who you really are. There is awareness of that. that the body is something that arises and ceases, the emotions arise and cease in awareness. And getting these perspectives of non-grasping or anatta or emptiness, whatever ways we talk about it, are they're very subtle kind of perspectives. They're not obvious. At first, you don't really know what it means. But if you keep cultivating them, and there's many ways to cultivate those perspectives of non-grasping, just the word non-grasping, or anicca, when you contemplate, you recollect uncertainty or change. To do that, you have to be in a place of non-grasping. If you're trying to change something, you're grasping, but to get to recollect anicca is a perspective of non-grasping. Anatta is a perspective of non-grasping. Dukkha, it's not there, can't be a condition, is the perspective. It's in awareness is the perspective, or this is empty of self is the perspective. And continually recollecting that is quite hard to do, because our usual perspective is self-view, attachment, self-identity, self-doubt, guilt, fantasizing, romanticizing, blah, blah, blah. And that's all through narrative, self-narrative, and thought. But the awakened mind is not a thought. Personality is a thought. Self is a thought. But the awakened mind is suchness. And that perspective is really what we're trying to do when we talk about bhavana. Samadhi helps. Sila helps. Panya helps. Yeah? And then bhavana is this sustained awakening. Sustained awakening. Not just a kind of one-off awakening. You might think that, oh yeah, if I really practice hard, then I'll get to some point and my head will blow open and I have nowhere to go. Good luck. But the perspective of non-becoming is awakening. So it's not like you're going anywhere with the winter retreat, but it's you coming back to here, to presence, to not-self, to emptiness. These different ways that we talk about it. So it's a lovely, lovely opportunity we have, and to use it well would be to not use it well would be a disservice, wouldn't it? To not realize how valuable this is, and that would be a disservice to the laity that support us. It would be a disservice to our parents, to our teachers, to not use it well. That's not to scare you. More to motivate you to realize this human birth is valuable, this opportunity to practice in this way is invaluable, and that the more we do that, it's interesting also, like solitude can create incredible camaraderie. If you've really worked at your practice, you've really done good work, you feel good with the other monks. If you haven't, if you've just sloped off, you don't want to see another monk. Because it reminds you, well, yeah, that's why I get this alms food. I don't want to see the brown room. But if you've really, really sustained a strong effort and worked very hard, then you can connect in a different way, a way of heartfelt aspiration. All right, I'll leave that for your reflection.
Andamayang obadatamakataya sadhu karang datamasi sadhu sadhu sadhu.